This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Everyone loves an epic story. Star Wars, Harry Potter, The Lord of the Rings, even the Bible. Right now, fans around the world are awaiting the conclusion of television's biggest epic, Game of Thrones. The eighth and final season of the HBO series premiered last night. It's unclear how many millions of fans watched the premiere, but some estimate more than a billion people are expected to watch this series worldwide. It has already entranced fans of all kinds, including some of you who left notes in our inbox.
I am indeed a fan of Game of Thrones, and the reason I find the show compelling is that I don't know what exactly is going to happen. You know, with characters that you thought that would live throughout the entirety of the show dying off in the first season, it's a show that really you can't honestly predict what may happen. You know, and that's something I feel like with other shows isn't as much of a thing, because you can see, oh, bad guy, that guy's probably gonna either die at the end of the season or whatever. You know, with this show, there's a bit more of an unpredictability.
My husband and I, we are Game of Thrones aficionados. The reason that I like Game of Thrones is that it is compelling television. It is well scripted. It is well acted, well directed. The special effects are phenomenal. I think that it sets the bar for any other television programming that anybody else wants to come out with. And I believe that it sets the bar high.
I find so many things compelling about the Game of Thrones. Great acting, drama, and dragons. I mean, come on, dragons?
Anything with dragons is worth watching. Thank you all very much for sharing your thoughts with us. But what is it about this epic story that resonates? How has it changed the way we watch television? And most importantly, who will rule on the Iron Throne? If the whole Iron Throne thing doesn't make sense to you, don't worry. This conversation is for fans and newcomers alike. So feel free to share your questions, your stories about being a fan, or your predictions for how the show might end. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us in studio is Travis Andrews, a pop culture reporter for The Washington Post. Travis, welcome to 1A.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Joining us from Chicago is Eric Adams, TV editor for the pop culture website The AV Club. Eric, welcome.
Hi, thanks. Very happy to be here.
And Samantha Ecker is a contributing writer for Watchers on the Wall. It's a site for fans of Game of Thrones and the novel that inspired it, A Song of Ice and Fire, written by George R.R. Martin. She also co-hosts its podcast, The Night's Cast. Samantha, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of 1A itself, so I'm fangirling a bit being able to be on the show.
Oh, goodness sake. That's very sweet of you. Thank you. And before we dive in, by the way, we will be discussing Game of Thrones in its entirety, including possibly the episode that aired last night. So consider this your spoiler alert. If you need to listen to this episode later, you can online at the1a.org. I'm interested briefly in how you all came to watch the show. Samantha, let me start with you. How did you get into Game of Thrones?
Sure. I actually started reading the books, and when the first season came out, I didn't have cable at the time, and that was, you know, back in 2011, so there wasn't, you know, there weren't streaming services or anything yet. And I had heard about the show when it first came out. Everyone was saying how great it was, and I thought, well, I don't have cable at the moment. So I picked up the books instead. And I first read them when I was on vacation with my family. I downloaded the first two onto my, like, first generation Kindle. And I thought, you know, I'll download two of them and I'll take them on vacation with me. And if I like them and if they're really good, you know, I'll keep going. And we were on vacation for about a week. And I think within the first maybe 4 days, I had blown through the first two books. They hooked me in a way nothing that I had read had hooked me in many years. And I couldn't wait to get home and download the others. So I actually read all of the books that were available the following year when season two was premiering. I had just met my now husband, who had just bought the DVD box set of season one. So we sat there and binged the entire first season, I think in maybe 2 weeks before season two started. And getting to watch it, having already read the books, getting to see visually what was created to tell the story of A Song of Ice and Fire was absolutely amazing. It just the show hooked me as much as the books did.
Truly,
so that's kind of how I came into it.
Truly a TV show bringing people together. That is very cool. Travis, Andrews, what about you? Did you watch the show just as a critic or also as a fan?
Well, I actually came to it a little bit late. I came to it in season four. I hadn't watched it. I was the stereotypical guy who's not really into fantasy, and everyone was saying you got to watch it. And as a pop culture reporter, it was a little embarrassing that I hadn't seen it. So I decided to give it a shot, and I'm embarrassed to say how quickly I binged the first three seasons in prep for season four, but I was instantly hooked. I just thought it was such a dense and complex and interesting show. Nothing happens that you expect to happen. And ever since then, I've been hooked as a fan, and this season I've been writing about it a lot.
Eric, what about you?
Yeah, I kind of started watching it out of professional obligation as well. I started on the TV beat at the AV Club shortly after the first season premiered. And, you know, I just kind of got caught up with it on the DVD sets. Probably around season three, I think, was maybe the first season that I watched it live. And then I recapped the show for a couple of seasons for the site. And at the AV Club, we write two sets of recaps, one for people who haven't read the books, which is where I fall in, and then another for people who have. So we can kind of, like, explore deeper into the lore and when the show wasn't ahead of the books, we could kind of like provide a space for people who knew what was going to happen to talk without spoiling the people who hadn't read the books.
Speaking of the lore, Eric, we should just do a really, really quick explainer for those folks who are listening but who've never seen Game of Thrones and boil it down. Essentially, at least as I see it, the show centers around two plot lines. There's the fight for the Iron Throne, and there's the coming war against the White Walkers. Let's take those one at a time. Eric, first of all, briefly just explain, what is the Iron Throne, and why does everybody want it?
The Iron Throne is the seat of power at the center of the Seven Kingdoms that make up the fictional continent of Westeros. And it's kind of been passed back and forth between all of these great houses of Westeros, currently in possession of House Lannister on the show now, who had taken it over from House Baratheon through a sort of marriage and a secret coup. And before the show began, it was in the possession of House Targaryen, a notorious house that had possession of dragons. That had disappeared before the show started, because the show starts during an age of Westeros where there is no magic.
And secondly, Samantha, the White Walkers. What are the White Walkers, and why are they such a threat?
So the White Walkers are a huge threat because they so we have the White Walkers, and then we also have kind of these undead zombies, if you want to call it that, that they create. The White Walkers are these figures that come from in the books anyway. They come from what's called the Lands of Always Winter, and it's the kind of cold, icy lands beyond the Wall. And the White Walkers have the ability to reanimate dead corpses into these kind of mindless ice zombies. And for centuries, for thousands of years, until the show has begun, the White Walkers had previously been in Westeros in an event called the Long Night. That was thousands and thousands of years ago, and they were slowly kind of trying to take over the entire continent, freezing people to death in their houses and turning people into these mindless zombies. Eventually, they were driven back, and that is actually when the Wall itself went up. And it happened such a long time ago that people in Westeros kind of think of it as a fairy tale. They think it never even happened. But unfortunately for them, it did happen, and it's happening again. And the White Walkers are a huge threat. And they don't have any regard for, you know, houses or loyalties or, you know, rich, poor. They just want to take over the entire continent and press everyone into their service.
Now, as we mentioned, the series is based on A Song of Ice and Fire by George R. R. Martin, a series of books that began with that. He spoke to Anderson Cooper on 60 Minutes about writing those books. Here he is describing the first scene he ever wrote for the books, when the Starks, which are one of the families that is vying potentially for the Iron Throne, when the Starks find pups, direwolf pups.
It was a scene that haunted me. The characters seemed so real. I knew right from the beginning, I mean, that first sentence, they find the direwolf pups in the summer snows. I knew they were the summer snows. So this was a place where it snowed even in summer. So what could result that? And, you know, wheels started turning. What kind of world would have that? Where do these people live? What is the rest of the kingdom like? And the world building grew parallel to the story. You know, I'm writing a story and someone makes a reference to some king who's been dead 100 years. And I threw a few of those in, and then I said, I better write a list of all these kings or I'm going to start contradicting myself. So I wrote a list of the Targaryen kings and the names of their reigns. And at some point I said, I better have a map. So I sat down and I drew a map, all while I was still writing the story.
That's George R.R. Martin talking about building the complex world of Westeros in an interview with Anderson Cooper on 60 Minutes. Samantha, you've read the books, and when we continue, I'd love your sense of the difference between the books and the shows, especially because the series is ending before the novels have been finished. We'll get to that in just a moment when we continue our conversation with Samantha Ecker of Watchers on the Wall and the podcast The Night's Cast, Eric Adams of the AV Club, and Travis Andrews of The Washington Post. We welcome your questions and thoughts as well. Quite a few different theories about who is going to end up on the Iron Throne. We'll get to some of your thoughts, and if you just have basic questions about the series, send them in, 1a@wamu.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you have bent the knee and pledged your undying loyalty to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Yes, now the rains we pour is whole, and now the soul to heal.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing Game of Thrones with The Washington Post's Travis Andrews, Eric Adams of the AV Club, and Samantha Ecker of Watchers on the Wall. Later, we'll hear from two members of the team that brought Game of Thrones to life. In the meantime, we welcome your questions and thoughts about the series, including your predictions about how you would like it to end. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. Samantha Ecker, I'd love your sense of the comparison between the series of books and the television show. We should note, for people who've never seen it, Game of Thrones has extended beyond the list of novels, the series of novels that George R.R. Martin has written. So it's kind of gone beyond what he wrote. And there are some mixed opinions about that from some of you. Christine emailed, I have been a fan since the beginning, watched episodes multiple times, and read all the books. I am pleased with how the series has continued the story beyond the author's story, as the books really dragged into book five. There just is no other reasonable end than Jon Snow and the Queen of Dragons on the Iron Throne. If it ends any other way, I will break all my Game of Thrones DVDs and burn all of my Game of Thrones books. But another listener wrote on our website, the1a.org, as a writer, I find it disheartening that the Game of Thrones show ran so far ahead of the books of Song of Ice and Fire. I know millions disagree, but isn't the original form more important than the offshoot? I wish they had waited for Martin to catch up. Samantha?
That's an interesting opinion, because on the one hand, you know, I want to agree that I wish that they maybe would have waited. But on the other hand, I think what the show creators, what David and Dan have done with the source material has really been incredible. I think that, first of all, the adaption, the way that they've adapted it has been really remarkable, because the source material itself is so dense and complex. There are so many stories and so many plot lines going on. I think that they've adapted the world of Westeros itself incredibly well to the screen. Everything that they've done in terms of special effects and costuming and the writing and the acting has been by and large phenomenal. I think that the issue that I might have with some parts of the adaptation has been with certain characters and with certain storylines. I think that some of the characters have really suffered in their page-to-screen adaptation. And I think that's mostly because A Song of Ice and Fire is written largely in POV chapters. So you really get to see inside a character's head as to why they're making a decision or why they don't make a certain decision. And you can do that in film or television with kind of an inner monologue thing. But since there is none of that in Game of Thrones, I think that some of the characters have suffered from us not being able to to see that inner, the inner workings of their minds and kind of just the surface decisions that they make. I think Sansa is a character that suffers from that. I think Daenerys definitely is. But by and large, considering what they were tasked with in terms of taking Martin's work and translating it into a television show, I think that they really have done a fantastic job. As far as taking the story beyond what's already been written in the books, it was a big gamble. I think it was a big risk for them to do that. Yeah. And I think that they've done it relatively well. I can see certain storylines in the show not ending up being too terribly different from how they'll be in the books. I mean, there are definitely big differences. I won't go into them just in case, you know, anybody's planning on reading the books. I don't want to spoil anything for anyone. So
one more comment about, oh, by the way, Dan and David that Samantha mentioned are Daniel Weiss, D.B. Weiss, and David Benioff, who are the co-creators and showrunners of Game of Thrones. They're the ones who convinced George R. R. Martin to allow them to adapt it for television. One more view on the books. Tony wrote on our Facebook page, "I've always loved well-written fantasy and science fiction. I was afraid HBO wouldn't do the books or G.R.R. Martin justice. To my surprise, HBO did an excellent job. It's good to hear that people who don't usually care for fantasy got hooked." Eric, I'd love your sense, and Travis, yours also, of the impact that Game of Thrones has had on television in general. Raja emailed, "The reason Game of Thrones is so compelling is that this is the first ever epic saga series to have been produced with blockbuster movie quality. Every early episode far surpassed anything else on TV, with great cinematography, locations, special effects, casting, and acting. Looking forward to another great saga that Amazon is producing, Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time series." Yeah, that should be interesting. Eric, I'm not sure I agree with Raja that this is the first series to do this. Shogun on ABC did this with James Clavell's novel. Roots on ABC did this with Alex Haley's novel. So I don't know that it's the very first, but I do take his point, Eric.
Well, and also those two examples you cite are miniseries, and that was kind of where television threw most of its money in the 70s and 80s and kind of tapered off in the 90s and the aughts. You would get these big epic novel adaptations in versions that like just ended, that had a closed-ended story, that weren't produced in the traditional American style of television where shows go on and on and on. You know, you'd get sequels. I think both of those miniseries wound up having sequels, and so did stuff like The Thornbirds. But to the point of the listener, the thing about the production values on Game of Thrones is so gigantic and so difficult to maintain over 7-8 seasons of television. And just in that genre, I think if you look back at when fantasy or when science fiction was done on television, we often see it in a kind of chintzier, lower rent version than what we would have gotten in the cinemas. You know, you think about back to the 60s, you think about Lost in Space, you think about the original Star Trek. You go forward to the 90s and you think about something like Xena Warrior Princess or Hercules, where the production values are a little chintzy, the costumes aren't great. This is a genre that's very difficult to do well because you have to pour a ton of money into it. And Game of Thrones, you can see that money in every single shot. Sometimes the CGI isn't great. Like, I did not love, and we're going to, here, I'll just get into spoilers from last night's episode. I didn't love the dragon riding sequence. I don't like any time any one of the physical actors has to interact with the dragons because it just, like, it puts the lie to the illusion that they've managed to create so well with the practical elements of the show, from the settings to the costuming to the set dressing. Like, you never feel the fakeness. You always feel like you're really in this world until, like, a CGI element kind of intrudes upon that.
Travis, what's your sense in terms of the way that has changed television? It seems like every now and then one of these shows comes along that is sort of water cooler television, for lack of a better word, the kind of thing that people are like, do not tell me what happened. Like, I'm going to go off Facebook for the next 24 hours because I can't watch it on my DVR until I get home from work on Monday. One of those kinds of shows. And there aren't many networks that have figured out how to do that. HBO seems to do it over and over. But and now Netflix has kind of changed the game as well with the way you just drop a whole series. I can only imagine if Game of Thrones had been dropped all in one binge, I think 30% of the American workforce would have called out sick.
No, absolutely. I think one thing that's important to remember is Game of Thrones is actually taking an older kind of style and approach. We often talk about the death of the monoculture, the death of appointment viewing, and there used to be shows that everyone would watch and talk about the next day, things like Lost. But, you know, Breaking Bad was really the last one we had before Game of Thrones came along because of the rise of Netflix and things like that. People watch things on their own time. They watch things in giant binge sessions rather than week to week. And what Game of Thrones did was capture that appointment viewing again. And I think one thing we're seeing is all these companies, Amazon with Lord of the Rings and Wheel of Time, we have Disney Plus with all the Marvel miniseries they just announced, everyone's trying to capture that appointment viewing again. And, you know, that's going to be a very difficult thing to do. And I think one thing that has come out of Game of Thrones is the idea that you can pour a ton of money into a show and maybe it's worth it. And that's one thing HBO has done. Each episode costs exorbitant amounts of money, but it's worth it because, look, we're talking about it right now, right? Everybody's talking about it today, and that is what they're looking for.
One listener of the 1A Text Club wrote, I watched one episode, enjoyed the music, drama, and special effects, but decided it was too violent for me. I really have to question the ethics and impact of watching high levels of violence for pure entertainment. Accurate historic documentation is appropriate, but the portrayal of violence just for its own sake does not seem like a good choice on any level. Samantha, that's something that I think some fans of the books have said about the TV series, like there were certain scenes, including some rape scenes, that didn't occur in the book, or even people who wanted to get into the television show kind of had to watch it with a squint because they knew sooner or later something was just going to be overwhelmingly violent in a way that just beggared the imagination.
Yeah, and I am one of those people who has watched some of those scenes with a cringe. There has definitely been the way in which certain things such as rape and sexual assault and sexual violence have been not handled well in the show. And that is definitely a big complaint that I have with it. And I don't think that I'm alone in that. But, you know, I can also, you know, I can admit that that's something that they have not handled well. And I can still enjoy the show. Maybe with a little bit of guilt about that, but
And Samantha, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you just clarify what you mean when you say it wasn't handled well? What exactly are you referring to?
Well, for example, there's a scene in season 5 when Sansa Stark is married to Ramsay Bolton back in Winterfell, and their wedding night scene involves Ramsay actually sexually assaulting Sansa in a pretty horrific way. And that scene is not something that's in the books. So they purposely kind of put that in there. And when you think about it, and Ramsay as a character himself is, you know, pretty psychopathic. So I suppose what they were trying to do is just say, hey, this, you know, could just kind of drive the point home as to Ramsay's character. But it was just completely unnecessary. It didn't need to be in there. And that, I know, is a big complaint that a lot of viewers have had, and myself included. I was not happy that they did that.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. One thing a lot of you described that you really love about the show was described in a number of messages, including from Laverne, who wrote on our Facebook page, what is special about Game of Thrones is the strong characters, especially the badass female characters. Dany, Arya, Sansa, Cersei, Lady Tyrell, Brienne, Ygritte, Lady Stark, Melisandre, Little Lady Mormont, and so many more. You can hardly find a troupe of woman actors as large, strong, and talented as the ladies of the game. Samantha Ecker, let me stick with you. I wonder how you see the overall portrayal of women in Game of Thrones, especially because some of these characters literally grew up on the show. I mean, the actress who plays Arya Stark, Maisie Williams, I think she was 12 when the show went on the air, and now she is a woman of her 20s.
Yeah, it is. I mean, first of all, it has been pretty fantastic to watch these characters grow up. But yeah, the female characters and the female representation in the show is pretty fantastic. Of course, there are a couple of quibbles, you know, like we mentioned about, you know, the sexual assault that really did not maybe need to be in there. But female characters are at the forefront in Game of Thrones, and it's the same way in the books as well. And in the books, it's slightly different. They don't some of them don't necessarily have as much agency as or autonomy as they do in the show. And even then, there have been certain characters who really kind of have to work behind the scenes, so to speak. Like Marjorie Tyrell is a character who I really love. She had a lot of power, but it was kind of like a quiet power because she was very good at manipulating Joffrey. She was very good at getting under Cersei's skin. She knew what she wanted, and she was going to get it. And so that was a good example of kind of like a quiet power, kind of succeeding despite, you know, being part of a male dominated world. I mean, you know, to be honest, Westeros is still very much a patriarchal society. But then you also have characters like Brienne, who are a fantastic representation of, you know, a strong woman, not just physically, but, you know, emotionally and mentally, because you would kind of have to be to deal with what Brienne has dealt with. You know, she's been mocked and made fun of her entire life for, you know, her size and her height and her what she likes to do with her life.
We should know, by the way, Brienne is a knight, basically.
Yes. Right. Yes. So, you know, and then there are also characters who have been a little bit, and I touched on this a little earlier, but for example, like Sansa, her treatment on the show has not been my favorite, because she is still portrayed very much as someone who is just kind of a pawn being moved around on the board by other players. That is still the case in the books, but in the books, her story is starting to change a little bit.
Eric,
and she has more agency over herself that they haven't given her in the show until very, very recently.
Eric, one of the things that a member of our 1A text club wrote says, I like that the bad guys actually have a chance. In virtually all dramas, you know from the beginning that the good guys will win. Game of Thrones is the first series to really cast that into doubt. No one knows how this story will end, but I know how I want it to end. The Night King is the right king. We got a lot of fans of the Night King on our audience. What is with you? Oh, fine. Okay. All right. But Eric, what about that? This idea that the bad guys are bad. Some of them, like Ramsay Bolton, get their just desserts, and that was one of the most satisfying things I ever saw on television. But, you know, it's possible that one of the bad guys could come out the winner in the end.
Oh, absolutely. And the show and the novels set that up very early on. You get this character in Ned Stark from the premiere where it's just like, okay, this is going to be the guy that we're going to follow all the way to the end. He's going to be the person we're going to pin our hopes on for changing the way that this world works. And then 9 episodes in, off goes his head.
Right.
So suddenly your feeling of fairness and what's at stake in this world gets totally flipped upside down. And it's such a simple but such an elegant storytelling device to kind of keep the audience on their toes like that. Sometimes the show has kind of tipped a little too far the scales in that regard. I think after the Red Wedding, it kind of developed this really unattractive bloodlust, where the thing about being unsure about anybody surviving just became like the driving force of the show. And it was just, hey, let's see who we can kill off this week.
We should note, by the way, the Red Wedding was a scene that is a very bloody, very violent revenge scene that takes place at a wedding that has one shot in particular that I think made a lot of people just kind of literally burst into tears at how violent it was.
Absolutely. And that, you know, it played into those expectations that the series has subverted, where you cannot expect anyone to survive to the end of this. But, you know, you can definitely go too far sometimes. And I think the show has at least pulled it back a little bit. But, you know, the Night King could kill everybody off. You never know. That's the beauty of this show.
That's one theory from one listener who tweeted, my Game of Thrones prediction, Daenerys Targaryen is pregnant by Snow, and the Night King is coming to claim the child he was promised. We'll continue in a moment with Eric Adams, Travis Andrews, and Samantha Ecker. We'll get some more of your questions and some of your predictions in just a moment. Stay close. The Back now to our conversation with Travis Andrews, Eric Adams, and Samantha Ecker. One listener of the 1A Text Club writes, Game of Thrones is a study of nations' tribalism with all the moral, ethical, and power struggles that are an integral part. What divides them? What can bring them together? How does power strengthen, weaken, and sadly, corrupt? Travis, that's one interesting aspect of this that a number of our listeners brought up in terms of kind of the metaphor of Game of Thrones. Another Text Club listener writes, one of the things that compels me most about the series is that Winter and the Army of the Dead are coming, an unstoppable force that no one faction in the Game of Thrones world can deal with alone. It mirrors our modern reality. As Jon Snow says, there is only one war, the Great War, and it is here. There's only one issue that deserves our attention, and it is climate change. We all need to rise to the challenge. Travis?
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. I think one of the most important aspects of the show, you mentioned there are two plot lines, who's, you know, vying for the Iron Throne, and then this threat coming to kill everybody. And we spend most of the show on who's vying for the Iron Throne. And now we're at the final season, and the big threat is finally here, and what needs to happen in Westeros and in this world is everyone needs to come together to fight the White Walkers. And even last night's episode, humans are squabbling over who's going to follow who. There's prejudice, there's sexism, there's racism in this world. And that ultimately could be what tears everyone apart. And so I think that's very clever. I think the metaphor climate change is a perfect example, but really anything beyond human concern that can kind of destroy us all if we don't come together and find solutions for our problems.
Eric Adams, how do you see it? It seems like Game of Thrones has so much in it that it can really be a Rorschach test for how you view the world. You know, you may view yourself in the eyes of Tyrion Lannister, the dwarf who's played by Peter Dinklage, who's won 3 Emmy Awards for playing Tyrion, in terms of being an outcast who finds his way in the world. You could see yourself in the eyes of Jon Snow, who's played by Kit Harington, in terms of this guy who is believed to be an outcast and then later learns he's not the outcast he thought he was. It feels in some ways, Eric, kind of like a Rorschach test.
Oh, absolutely. And that's kind of the stroke of brilliance of writing the novels from the points of view of the characters, is that you really can put yourself in their shoes and kind of imagine what your place within this sort of medieval social structure would be. Of course, we don't get a whole lot of views from, like, the street level of Westeros. We don't hear from a lot of the peasants who live in Flea Bottom. We're still very concerned with the people who are at the top of the hierarchy. But, you know, you can, as fantasy and science fiction long have, they provide this sort of escapist allegory that you can project yourself onto to get away from the vagaries of everyday life, even as much as the story in that show may reflect the struggles that we have in our lives, both interpersonally and in a larger picture.
Samantha, in terms of that larger narrative, in terms of what we read into it, I totally understand the climate change aspect. That's kind of what I took from it, too. Like, we have these little petty squabbles, but there is this gigantic threat that we all need to unify on, and we can't because we've got these petty squabbles. I wonder what your thought is on the impact of a message like that. Let me get to a few more comments from listeners. Mike wrote on our Facebook page, the last show we will watch together will be the final few episodes of The Simpsons. But yes, we are far from the days of MASH and Dallas. And Dan tweeted, I never watched an episode. I'm a one percenter. So it seems like there is this message, but then a lot of people might not get it because we're not in the days where, like, everyone watches the season finale of one show all at the same time.
Sure. And as far as, you know, sending a message, I think I agree with everything that's been said about the fact that there, and I could be wrong, but I think that George R. R. Martin has said in an interview that he has kind of envisioned the White Walkers as this kind of very large threat akin to climate change. You know, that, again, we all kind of need to come together in order to defeat. As far as, you know, the show having an impact as to, you know, real world change on that, I would hope so. But, you know, I'm also kind of it is still just a television show, no matter how many people watch it. As far as my thoughts on why the show is so popular, though, and why so many people watch it and so many people kind of unify behind it, is because it is relatable, whether or not we realize it. Maybe it is relatable because, you know, we're kind of seeing that allegory for climate change in the White Walkers, and we're seeing the necessity to really for people to put aside differences and come together and solve this one giant problem. But it's a very relatable show in that sense, but also in the ways that we do see ourselves through the characters' eyes. You know, a lot of people can see themselves as a Tyrion. You know, they've always had strife with their family members. They've always felt like a disappointment. People see themselves as an Arya or a Sansa because they have sibling rivalry or something like that. So I would definitely, and I think the show is absolutely going to have a long lasting impact. But I think obviously it's going to be more on, you know, the pop culture side of it than everybody saying, hey, just like they did on Game of Thrones, let's all, you know, put aside our differences and solve climate change.
With regards to the impact of the show, we had the pleasure of speaking to two members of the show's team, production designer Deborah Riley and executive producer Bernadette Caulfield. They were at a Smithsonian Associates event here in Washington. Here's a part of their conversation with 1A's Jonquilin Hill.
How does it feel to be part of something that has touched so many people and so many viewers and, you know, brought so many people together?
The whole experience for me, I don't think I've even quite understood yet. It makes me feel quite speechless, actually. I don't know how to properly describe it. And I've felt quite confused since I've finished it. I can't answer the question. I don't know yet. And maybe in 20 years I'll be able to answer it. But now I still feel too attached to it and too close to it.
Yeah, I feel there's a tremendous amount of gratitude that I feel to have been given this gift of working on the show. And so many people came into the show in many different ways. You know, either they fell into it or somebody left who you didn't think of. And to me, it was, you know, magical maybe is the wrong word. But we were all supposed to be there together. And I just feel like it was a tremendous gift that we all received. And I'm just tremendously grateful that it's something that doesn't happen in your whole lifetime to be on something so successful that people love so much. And, you know, I'm just grateful for it, really.
Those were production designer Deborah Riley and executive producer Bernadette Caulfield of Game of Thrones speaking at a Smithsonian Associates event to 1A's Jonquilin Hill. Tom's email gets to another aspect of this program that I think is worth mentioning. Tom emailed, "While I have great admiration and respect for the talented cast and crew of Game of Thrones, I had to quit watching the show after season 3 because I was sincerely too traumatized to take it anymore. I think it took me a year to get over the castration scene, which, by the way, was not in the book. I still find that when watching movies these days, I'm often ready for awful things to happen to people when you think that they're in the clear, which was often a technique used in Game of Thrones to provoke emotion." Travis Andrews, I have never heard of so many people being traumatized by a TV show as I have with Game of Thrones. And if you don't believe me, I got one word for you. Hodor.
No, absolutely. You know, one of the jokes about HBO for a long time was always...
And I know that around the country, when I said Hodor, a bunch of people went, oh.
But yeah, so HBO, you know, has long been known for inserting nudity and violence when maybe it's not necessary into shows, and Game of Thrones absolutely takes the cake. Over the Washington Post, we did a death count, a little graphic, and we're almost at 3,000 people who have been killed in various ways, and animals, I should say.
Yeah.
If something lives in Game of Thrones, it can be killed, and it will be killed in the most horrific way you can possibly think of, and they're not going to look away for the show. As was mentioned earlier, it's actually gotten a little less violent, and there's been less gratuitous nudity as the show's gone on, because so many people, like that listener, has complained and said, you know, we're traumatized, we can't take this.
But it's so traumatic. Like, what is it, Travis, that keeps people watching? It's almost like people will watch through the trauma because they want the trauma to be redeemed. Like, I know they didn't do this to my brain just to leave me this way.
Oh, absolutely. People are hoping to have that storytelling device where in the end they feel good. And one thing about Game of Thrones is you don't often leave feeling good. As Eric mentioned, all of our characters that we thought were the good guys have slowly been killed in terrible ways throughout the show, and we're not left with very many.
Although there is a few. Ramsay Bolton, I'm telling you, man.
that was a lovely scene.
That was very... I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Let me get to a few of your predictions about how the show will end before this show ends. One listener tweeted, "I love Game of Thrones because I just love looking at Jon Snow. Of course he's going to take the Iron Throne. He's the heir and he's beautiful." Another listener tweeted, "I'm Team Tyrion and Sansa for the Iron Throne." That would be interesting. Another listener tweeted, "The satisfactory and shocking Game of Thrones ending I want, but also dread, is the one where the Night King wins." The Night King is the head of the White Walkers. I wouldn't be mad if Jon is king too, though. Michael tweeted, "Big fan, impatiently waiting and waiting for Winds of Winter. Predictions? The books are based on War of the Roses, but also the Children's Crusade. The children end up ruling, since all the adults are dead." Andy emailed, "The show will end when Daenerys Targaryen, the woman with the dragons, Daenerys Targaryen uses Drogon's flames to melt the Iron Throne and forms a ruling council, finally breaking the wheel." And Ruben tweeted, "It's interesting how everyone is talking about who will sit in the throne at the end of the series. However, nobody talks about the possibility of no longer having just one throne, but a union of thrones that rule Westeros." Samantha, it's amazing how many different possible endings there are. I wonder how you see it.
It absolutely is amazing how many different takes there are on the ending. As for how I see it, personally, I agree with the listener who submitted the theory that there will be no more Iron Throne. I think that part of this story, part of what Game of Thrones does and part of what George R. R. Martin has done in the books as well, is he's shown us lots of situations that have happened before. And then he's either turned them on his head or he has kind of given them a different ending. And I think that I think the proper ending to Game of Thrones is, you know, no more magic, no more dragons. I'm sorry, listeners, if you're fans of dragons, I really am, but I think that all the dragons are going to be gone as well. The dragons are going to be gone. Magic is going to be gone. The White Walkers are going to be gone. The Iron Throne is going to be gone, because really kind of what is happening here is that there's not really any middle ground, as Cersei Lannister has told us. There's not really a middle ground in between the White Walkers being defeated and not defeated. It's going to result in a massive change in Westeros, how things are governed. I do believe that there is going to be no more Iron Throne, that it is going to be destroyed. Personally, I would love to see Dany as the ruler. And again, kind of that idea that listener had about overseeing like a ruling council. We know Dany has spoken about breaking the wheel. I firmly believe that she is still she still believes in that, and that's going to be her goal. I would love to see Sansa on the Iron Throne, but I think Sansa is going to stay. She's going to be queen in the North. That's where she's going to be.
Eric, what do you think? How's it going to end?
I think if we were having this conversation a few years ago, maybe we would have thought that things would have come to a more negative ending. But I'm in agreement with Samantha. I think there's been so much talk as the series has gone on, especially from Daenerys, about changing the world and changing the way that this these seven kingdoms operate, that you've gotten to a point where the narrative becomes a little bit more conventional, that you can see a happier ending or a happy-ish ending at least coming. And I think if the forces of the living manage to defeat the forces of the dead, then we will no longer see any sort of monarchy in Westeros.
Travis?
You know, I have to agree with both Eric and Sam. I think that's how it's going to go, though I do think there's something to be said for the Night King winning. I hate to say that on national air, but I think that since so much of the show is about humans not being able to overcome these squabbles, and we're still seeing them with only 5 episodes left, I would not be shocked if the Iron Throne is destroyed by the Night King and his White Walkers.
One last comment, and Jamile emailed, "You're fixing me to watch this show as a cultural imperative. After episode 2, I found the sex and violence to be gratuitous. Now I have to believe that it genuinely helps tell the story. Okay, I'll do my socio-cultural homework." Samantha, before we go, very, very briefly, for people who've never watched Game of Thrones, maybe avoided it, but now they're thinking, okay, fine, but it's so daggone complex. Where do they start as new fans if they want to jump in now? Before we go.
Well, I mean, I would tell them to start with the books, but that's only because that's where I started. But there are also lots of really great podcasts out there. I guess I'll plug my own, which is the Knight's Cast. It's the official podcast of our website. But there are a lot of really great podcasts that some are spoiler free. So they, you know, will discuss characters in depth and everything like that without really ruining anything about the story for you. That might be a good place to start if you want to know if you want to know more about like the relatable kind of side of the story. But honestly, just dive in. Just do it. Binge the first season and see if you like it.
Samantha Ecker, contributing writer for Watchers on the Wall and co-host of the podcast The Knight's Cast. Samantha, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Eric Adams of the AV Club. Eric, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Travis Andrews, pop culture reporter for the Washington Post. Thanks, Travis.
Thanks so much for having me.
A producer has a name. A producer is Jonquilin Hill. To learn more about her and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A. Raise your sword in the sky. Raise it like you plan.